everything is working here. I hope. Yeah, I think we're all right now. And as I explained, I think somewhere along the line, we said we're going to record this and then we'll transcribe it and send you a copy. And you can do your own edits.
You may or may not have a copy of this, but that's an updated beta.
Good. I don't know. I don't have that.
Yeah,
that
okay.
Very helpful. Thank you.
A lot of the stuff we'll cover on career happenings and events and things like that are more or less chronicled in there.
Okay.
And so that'll be more of a source document. But rather than try to take the time to dig through it now, why...
Sure.
Proceed at your own pace
okay.
and risk, and I'll try to...
Let me just indicate for the record, today is December 8th, 1994, and this is Jim Boning talking with James D. Idle, Jr. in his office at Rutgers.
And it's B-O-H-N-I-N-G.
That's correct. Dr. Idle, I know you were born in...
How about just Jim?
Jim? Okay. Yeah. I know you were born in Harrisonville, Missouri on August 7th, 1928. Could you tell me something about your father, mother, and your family background?
My father was a third-generation newspaper editor and publisher. We published a country weekly called the Cass County Democrat, which was not as political as the name sounds. It was just the name of the paper as it came into being. My mother was a... teacher of languages in Missouri schools, and was a graduate of University of Missouri and University of Chicago, and spoke five languages and played the piano. I had one sister, and still have, who is now married and lives in Arlington, Virginia. We had a very happy childhood. Harrisonville was a city of 2,300 people, and in the early 30s, why we endured the dust storms and depression, and you'll probably want to know about this, so I'll save us a little time and trouble. The family who lived next door to me had a son who was 8 years older than I, who was an Eagle Scout, and was in the process of getting his chemistry merit badge.
Mm-hmm.
And at the age of six, why... I was exposed to his chemistry set and became fascinated with it and helped him do his Boy Scout experiments.
Okay, I didn't realize Boy Scouts had a chemistry merit badge.
Yes, indeed. Yes.
You went to schools, your local schooling was all in Harrisonville?
All in Harrisonville. We had the standard eight grades of elementary school and four years of high school, which I managed to get through in 3.5 years.
Extracurricular activities, athletics?
Not too much in athletics. Even as a boy, I enjoyed golf and tennis. I was never rough enough, I guess, for football, and I was too slow for basketball. As I said, I did enjoy golf at an early age and did a lot of fishing and camping with my grandfather and father. Became something of an outdoorsman.
You said you started doing chemistry experiments at the age of six.
Well, helping is a better way to put it, yes.
What was it about those experiments that fascinated you?
Well, simply that one seemed to have some power to observe things that you could control, and you could hopefully expect what was going to happen, and when it didn't, why, it gave you something to puzzle and wonder about.
Did you ever acquire a set of your own?
Oh, yes. I started on that very quickly after having early lessons from Ed Clatworthy, and I guess I began to assemble my own chemistry set by the time I was in the second grade, and it gradually grew until it occupied about a third of the basement of my house.
I'm assuming your mother and father supported you in this, or were they tolerant at least?
With some apprehension, I would say.
Did you manage to smell up the house on occasion?
On a few occasions, and once I blew out a basement window drying some nitrogen iodide.
Okay. But you were still encouraged to do this.
Yes, I was, yes. My father, I think, and the rest of his side of the family were a bit disappointed that I didn't take up the journalistic profession, which my sister obligingly did, and she was a journalism graduate from Missouri University. But I seemed always to enjoy chemistry and science, but chemistry was always the favorite. I considered medicine for a while, but chemistry was really more fascinating, and my family was average means during the Depression, but the price of a medical education was not in our pocket at that time.
What would you like in your tea? Nothing?
Nothing, just the way it is.
All right.
Thank you.
That probably played a role.
Mm-hmm. I'm assuming that because of the newspaper business, your family survived the Depression with...
Yes, the newspaper business was a good business to be in, and it brought with it the opportunity to get acquainted with some fairly prominent people. My father was not a close friend, but a good friend of Harry Truman, and I believe I recall him being at dinner at our house a couple of times when he was a judge of the Jackson County Court in Kansas City.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. I'm assuming that also from your mother's standpoint, being as well-educated as she was and prolific in languages, that she must have had some influence on you as well.
Very much so. I suppose one must always lean a little bit towards one parent or the other, and possibly because she was a little bit more sympathetic to the smells and explosions than father was, that had its effect. And World War II, Dad wasn't... he was just a little bit too old to be drafted or serve, but he was determined to serve, and so he went to the Red Cross and served 4 years as, what was his title? Field director in the Red Cross for the China-Burma-India Theater, and he was gone 4 years, and so I had to... It was a single-parent home all of that time, so I guess that unavoidably got me a little closer to my mother than my father.
What was your science experience like in high school?
Well, it was, I think, above average. I think Harrisonville High School was not particularly noted, as some others are, for science instruction. It was the high school had 250 students in it, and the superintendent taught the chemistry and physics courses ably. I was more influenced during those years by a close family friend who was the superintendent of the city light and water plant by the name of Cleo Brown. And he and my father were business acquaintances because father was mayor of the city in the years just prior to World War II, and Cleo was not a chemist himself. I believe he was not a college graduate, but was of necessity conversant in water chemistry testing and that sort of thing, so he was very good at loaning me an old chemistry book, which really was my first introduction to any organized form of chemistry education, and that was handed to me when I was in the sixth grade. And then he helped with a steady supply of laboratory equipment and chemicals, which I never had enough money for.
You don't remember what the book was, do you?
I wish I did. I preserved it for many years in my laboratory, one of the laboratory drawers in the basement, and I arrived home from a vacation one time many years later when I was first employed, to find out that mother had finally decided that the collection of materials in the basement, which hadn't been touched for 15 years, was becoming a hazard, and it was all gone. Donated, I must say, to the local high school, but after they had taken their pick, I don't know where the rest of it went, and that book was in one of those drawers.
Okay.
Um,
I guess I'm not familiar with William Jewell College. I know it's a Baptist college. I don't know where Liberty, Missouri is in comparison to Harrisonville.
Well, Harrisonville is 40 miles south of Kansas City, near the Kansas line. And Liberty is 15 miles northeast, more north and east of Kansas City. It's halfway between Kansas City and Excelsior Springs, which might ring more of a bell. And it's a very old city, supposedly one of the wagon trains that went on the Oregon Trail, I think it was, or supposed to have left from the courthouse steps there at Liberty. William Jewell was founded in 1949 by a wealthy physician from Columbia, Missouri, who was a Baptist and wanted to have a Baptist college. I had no connection with the Baptist church except the fact my grandmother was a Baptist, but it had, for a small college in western Missouri, quite a good reputation in science and mathematics especially. And so as a matter of elimination, I suppose, combining the best available of what could be afforded, why I wound up going to William Jewell. Glad I did. I think there is very, very much to be said with the idea of the small liberal arts college, at least in those days.
Could we shut that door? There's noise, I'm afraid.
Yeah,
might
that machine is driving in need of oil.
Thank you.
Is that enough?
That's fine.
And it's a beautiful campus. I would do it again, whatever choices were given me. I could have gone to UM or UKansas or something else, but I chose William Jewell.
What was the chemistry department like?
Chemistry department was a two-and-a-half-man department, staffed by two professors who became really my tutors and in later years fast friends. The person in charge of the freshman chemistry sections was a gentleman of the name of Professor Henry with an I, Godfrio, G-O-D-F-R-I-A-U-X, who in fact had, it turns out, known my mother since she was a native of Marshall, Missouri, and he had taught in Marshall High School. And he also coached part-time the football squad. The real figurehead there, who probably did more to get my career directed and launched than anyone else, was Dr. and Professor Frank Edson, PhD from the University of Colorado, who taught the upper undergraduate courses. And I just can't really say enough about Dr. Edson. He was a scholar, and a scientist.
What were their physical facilities like?
Well, they were quite good for the size of the school and the time. We had pretty modern equipment in all the analytical and organic and physical chemistry courses. We had first-class spectrometers to work with as physical chemistry students, and we had the latest organic laboratory equipment. The freshman laboratories were a bit spartan, as many of them are, but the equipment was pretty good.
Were there many chem majors?
During the years I was going through, I believe we graduated probably 8 to 10 chem majors per year out of a graduating class of probably I'm sorry, I don't have that figure. It's probably the graduating classes were 100 a year.
Well, that's a good percentage, then.
Yes, it is.
Very good.
Maybe 150. Yeah. Physics was also strong at William Jewell, and so was math. And biology wasn't far behind.
What part of chemistry interested you most as you took the different types of courses?
Well, I don't think I really made a choice by the time I had come out of school. I had looked forward to physical chemistry because I was always fascinated with the way physical chemistry enabled one to mathematically correlate happenings with observations. and offered one at least presumably the opportunity to calculate what might happen instead of watch it happen. But I liked organic very much from the standpoint of synthetic. Synthetic chemistry.
Did you have any chance to do any research of any kind?
In the graduate, or in the senior year, during the time I was there, Dr. Edson decided to offer a senior seminar type course in Introduction to Chemical Literature and Research. And I did a, a short a little senior research project, which he, of course, had devised, and it was to assess the corrosivity of different types of acidic materials on the metal cadmium. I'm not just quite sure why he chose cadmium, but at any rate, I was presented with a series of cadmium coupons and told to go ahead and do the research on it and set up a series of experiments to determine, largely by weight loss techniques, what this corrosive effect would be. And so the project got launched, and most of it got done by the time I had to graduate at the senior commencement. It was a second semester course, and it was very fascinating. It was kind of irritating to find that some of the coupons didn't behave as they were supposed to, since the corrosive products were not soluble in the solvent, so the coupon gained weight instead of losing it, so we had to make some baseline adjustments. But he was fairly pleased, I think, with a little bit of work. It was my first introduction to chemical abstracts.
Ah, okay. I was going to ask if you had had a course that they were common at the time, either in history of chemistry or chemical literature, or you didn't have a specific course in chemical literature?
Well, I had that course at Purdue. I had Mellon's course.
Oh, yes.
Chemical literature, okay. Which, of course, is, I think, without peer.
Yes.
But even at William Jewell, Dr. Edson got us into that. And in his lectures in organic and physical chemistry, was very careful to point out the contribution of historical figures in chemistry. We were lucky to have him do that.
What was your thought as you were going through William Jewell about what you were going to do with your career after you left?
Well, I really never thought of anything other than graduate school. when I got my degree from William Jewell in 3.5 years, I was urged to take a couple of job offers just to make sure that I wasn't depriving myself of something that I would have been interested in, so I interviewed an insurance company, which made me a rather astonishing offer, which I almost took. The money sounded pretty good. But I applied to 4 graduate schools and was accepted by all. These were Cornell, Purdue, Illinois, and Iowa State, and chose Purdue largely upon the recommendation of Dr. Edson, because I had begun to become interested in industrial chemistry and chemical engineering, and he thought that would be a fine solution to that ambition.
What developed your interest in industrial chemistry?
I don't really know. I suppose the study of the processes for production of materials as we were presented with them in inorganic and freshman and later in organic chemistry.
So you went to Purdue in 1949. What was Purdue like when you got there?
Well, it was 11,000 students, and the chemistry building was a third of the size that it was when I left, and a sixth of the size that it is now since they built the second chemistry building. The faculty, as I recall, was about 20 or 25, and at the time I arrived, Earl McBee, who was a William Jewell graduate, had just become chairman of chemistry at Purdue, So I guess it was foreordained that I would work for him, but I had developed an interest in halogen chemistry even before leaving William Jewell, so that made the choice pretty easy.
What kind of research did you do? Well, let me back up a moment. You mentioned Mellon's course. I'd like to ask you a little bit more about that course and about Mellon and what your reaction was to.
Well, Dr. Mellon was an unusually talented and absolutely fabulous teacher. It was a pleasure just to sit in the class and listen to him lecture about the value of chemical literature and how it should be approached and handled. It was, of course, before the days of computers, and it was all handwork, but being led through Beilstein and chemical abstracts and the other reference works in inorganic chemistry, Gmelin and others, and how they organized the literature was totally fascinating.
You worked with, I think I have a copy of your paper here, with McBee. At least I thought I had noted it. It was a paper from your PhD thesis.
Yeah.
On provided spectra of chlorine-containing cyclopentenes.
Now you've done your homework. actually, my master's thesis, which for some reason we didn't publish, I think maybe he was waiting for some others to come along that he could combine it with, was on substitution reactions of 1,2-bis-trifluoromethylbenzene, hexafluoroxylene, if you will. And that was interesting. We went through some exercises to make some novel nitro and amino and diazonium compounds and things like that. It was sponsored by Westinghouse, so I was a Westinghouse fellow at the master's level, which was slightly unusual.
Yeah, so you didn't have to do any teaching?
Yes, I taught extensively.
Oh, you did?
There was due to some reverses in the family business, why the financial situation in the family had gotten pretty rugged at that time, and my sister had also entered college. So I did quite a bit of extra teaching, and the result was that I stretched my PhD education out a little bit longer than it otherwise might have been.
I see.
And also complicated by the fact that I decided that I was going to take a chemical engineering minor for the PhD, and I started that a year later than I should have, so that kind of spread things out. But I have no regrets for the slightly longer period of time I stayed at Purdue. It was a fascinating place, and I enjoyed it.
Why did you, well, you had this interest in industrial chemistry. Is that why you selected chemical engineering?
I think so. And Dr. McBee was very strong in his support of the idea. He was a very industrially oriented person himself, and the combination worked out to be exactly what I expected. Also, the person under whom I took most of my chemical engineering was Nora Shreve.
Oh, yes.
Who served on my doctoral committee.
Okay.
And it was interesting to sit in his classes.
How many chemical engineering courses did you take?
12 hours, 12 okay. credits, which were at the undergraduate level, Chemical Process Industries, his famous textbook course, and then one semester, as I recall, of unit operations, and then I took the graduate course in two semesters in unit processes in organic technology, which was basically a combination organic chemical engineering graduate course combined with a full-scale organic synthesis laboratory where we synthesized chemicals in 10-gallon reactors and used plate and frame filters and things like that. So it was really an education.
So you were able to combine this interest in organic chemistry, but with a leaning towards the industrial aspect.
Yes.
Although your PhD thesis was almost strictly organic chemistry.
Entirely, and largely synthetic and proof of structures.
I'm curious how Shreve served on your committee then.
Well, at Purdue, one had a committee composed of his major professor and professor representing each of the two minor fields, and my minor fields were chemical engineering, and the other was a split minor between inorganic and analytical. So I tried to cover as much ground as I could.
They say you covered pretty much all the bases in that respect.
It took a year longer to do it, but it was worth the while.
What were your thoughts as you were finishing up this your graduate work as to what you would do?
Well, I was sure I was going to take a job in industry at that point, and I had rather thought that I would like to return to native Missouri, or at least the Midwest, and I had made a few trips to the East by then, largely on interview trips, and enjoyed it, but my heart was, and perhaps still is, largely west of the Mississippi. But fate determined otherwise, and when I was in the interviewing process, one day Dr. McPhee brought a gentleman by the name of Dr. Everett Hughes, Mike Hughes, through my laboratory, and he turned out to be the research director of Standard Oil of Ohio, and he said, "Jim, this is Dr. Hughes, tell him some things about your work." So I gave him my 15-minute carefully rehearsed speech for guided tours and so on. McBee was always bringing his people through labs to introduce him to his students. He was very good about that. And so I was somewhat surprised a week later to receive an application form from Dr. Hughes. So I filled it out and sent it in, and an interview trip resulted, and an offer resulted, and I took it.
What other places had you interviewed?
Well, I interviewed at DuPont and at a firm in Chicago, one of the halogen companies, Velsico, I guess it was, Triple M, one or two others, I don't remember now.
What was it about Sohio that made you lean in that direction?
Well, they were not a small company, but they were not one of the giants like DuPont, in which I was a little bit afraid of getting lost. And I was very intrigued by the interview there, particularly by a gentleman by the name of Dr. Frank Veach, who was a Stanford organic chemist. It's not awfully well known. Got a frog in my throat today. But Standard of Ohio was one of the earliest companies to do pioneering partial oxidation work on hydrocarbons. Mm. It's often thought that Shell Chemical and Carbide perhaps pioneered a little bit more in that area, but if you examine the dates, I think one would find that Sohio was among the earliest. And Veach was Veach was directing research in those areas, and while he didn't reveal the details of it to me at the time, why he indicated that was their area. And I had, by that time, felt the need of some relief from halogen chemistry. So, though I continued to be fascinated by it, but partial oxidation was something that I was interested in, and we had made some phthalic anhydride by catalytic oxidation in my chemical engineering course at Purdue, and I thought, well, this sounds pretty interesting, so let's think about this one carefully. So they made an offer, and I accepted, with the condition that I work in his group.
Okay. Was their salary offer competitive?
More than, yeah, quite good. Can't remember at the time, but it was close to or over $600 a month, which was at the top range that PhDs were then getting.
You started at Standard Oil in 55.
Right.
Moved to Cleveland. What was it? Well, Cleveland's still Midwest. It's not.
Well, yeah. The transition to Cleveland wasn't too difficult. I seemed not to have too much trouble making friends most places, and it was a bigger city than I had ever lived in before, but it was, I was lucky to alight in a nice part of town, and the place where I lived, as we talked at lunch, was only two doors or two blocks down the street from the Grace Lutheran Church. So I, having been mostly always a churchgoer, and still am, found my way down there the very first Sunday and made some friends, and so my life in Cleveland was never dull.
What was the group like when you, well, I guess I have several questions. What was the group like when you joined it, and then on a broader picture of what research was like at Standard Oil at that time?
Well, the group that I joined was a group of approximately, must have been 15 or 20 people, all reporting to Dr. Veach, who had the title of a section supervisor, and largely because of the work that we did, why he, along with the rest of us, advanced through the ranks, and at the time he retired, why he was director of research for polymers, petrochemicals, and new processes. But the original group of 15 or 20 was mostly focused on partial oxidation chemistry, and there was it had its own little analytical branch, which included the infrared capability in the laboratory. And then there was one project which was polymer-related, which had to do with the manufacture of microballoons, which you've probably heard of. Well, microballoons are very, very small, less than 100 micron hollow spheres of plastic which float on oil tanks and help prevent the evaporation of volatiles.
Okay.
That had been accomplished. That was Veach's invention. And at that time, they began working on glass microballoons. So I was never involved in that, but was a good friend of the project leader who worked on it. So I began working in this group.
Were you given a specific assignment when you first started?
Not specific, which was something that really intrigued me. They had identified propylene selective oxidation, or perhaps propane, but more than that, propylene as the area of probably greatest opportunity. And they had made significant progress in a selective catalyst for oxidizing propylene to acrolein. And my task was to read through as many of their reports as I could digest in a three-month period and concoct a suggestion as to how I felt, what kind of research I felt should be done on the further utilization of acrolein, which was, of course, a very reactive intermediate, but not very useful by itself at that point. So, with a little bit of coaching, but largely based on ideas I think I had developed myself, why Dr. Veach and I concluded that we should work on the further oxidation of acrolein to acrylates and acrylic acid derivatives, and or try and selectively epoxidize the double bond to glycidaldehyde, which would have been an intermediate for glycerin. So I took off in those two directions and pursued them simultaneously.
It's intriguing that you were allowed or asked to spend time to come up with your own suggestions at that point.
I felt very good about that. I was taken completely by surprise. And so I was given a desk in an office and as much secretarial help as I needed and access to the library and pretty much left alone, except Frank and the other fellows would come around every other week or so and say, what's new today?
I was going to ask if you had group meetings or seminars or how you communicated amongst yourselves as to what was going on.
Well, within Veach's group, it was small enough that communication was never a problem. We had weekly group meetings for all the senior professionals, doctorals, and higher. And Veach himself was a communicator par excellence, and so there was no problem of any kind there, and there was quite a free interchange of ideas. Within the laboratory, Hughes had each project reviewed annually, and this took the form of a typical project review with transparencies and lectures and so on. And he made quite a thing of these reviews, and it was a chance for the individual investigator to respond to the group as well as to the management about what they had done. I suppose they did the same thing in other companies, but Hughes did it very well. And so that was a method of communicating across disciplinary lines. Within the laboratory, we seem to have overlooked that, or I did. There was the petrochemical research group, which Veach had. There was the mobile fuels research group, which Sam Darling had. And Sam Darling was one of the other people I interviewed on my first trip there, who was a pretty fine organic chemist himself, and graduate of Western Reserve, and spent quite a bit of time explaining things to me. So if I hadn't worked for Veach, I would have worked for Darling. Then there was the heavy products and asphalt research division. Apart from the fuels research division, there was the fuels evaluation, which included the motor laboratories, engine test blocks, and things like that. There was what was called the basic research division, which was headed by Arthur L. Jones, Letcher Jones, who were doing work in thermal diffusion, some different types of catalytic conversion of materials, and some other things I'm sure I don't remember by now. And then the analytical and library, and a very modest pilot plant division. When we moved from the old Cornell Road Laboratory, which is where this was all occurring, in the fall of 57 to the new research center on Warrensville Road, the structure of the organization remained very much the same through all that period, which I think is a tribute to Hughes' foresight. The main thing that was added at the Warrensville location, where there was room for it, was the a major pilot plant expansion and capability, which by that time was needed because we had made the acrylonitrile invention, which had to be pilot planted.
This is one thing that came up in my discussion yesterday with Edith Flanagan, is that when they moved from Tonawanda to Tarrytown, it was a disruptive influence in the organization, in the research organization. So your move, I mean, the fact that didn't happen in this case.
No, I think organizationally it was remarkably non-disruptive, perhaps because it was carried out in stages. And the petrochemical group was, in fact, the first to move. And we were in our laboratories and had our advancement scale equipment, or bench scale equipment, as opposed to exploratory scale, if you wish, installed and operating at the time the rest of the groups moved in. But that was Veach. He was always one jump ahead of the rest.
Okay. Do you feel that at that time there was a real emphasis on the part of the company, and I'm not sure how much feeling you had for the higher up administrative part of the company, towards what Willard Dow called patient money and a prayerful attitude, that there was time and money to do exploratory work, or was there more emphasis on direction of work?
Well, I have the impression that that the senior management was very much oriented toward process research and support, because I have completely forgotten and failed to mention that there was a completely different an additional laboratory which was larger than the research laboratory, which was the development laboratory, which was adjacent to the refinery. And there was a complete refinery pilot plant in operation at that time, and related research services and things like that. And there was a little bit of competition, but in general, quite a lot of collaboration between the laboratories. And I made some pretty good friends at that laboratory also, particularly one I remember, Oscar Kropp, who was one of the section managers there, who delighted in exchanging humors with me. So it was pretty good. But I would say that organization, even at the top levels, and I think I was able to shake hands with several of the vice presidents and the president within the first year of my arrival, was probably because Dr. Hughes was very, shall I use the word, diplomatically skilled at presenting the research case to the senior management.
Okay.
And a lot of what Ohio achieved has to be has to take recognition of his skill in guiding programs and people.
I've noticed that success of a research group often depends on someone being able to sell the senior management on projects and ideas that they have.
Well, I think he was pretty good at that, and he was lucky in having as his superior a fellow of the name of Elliot McConnell, who was senior vice president for manufacturing. And the way Standard Oil of Ohio was organized, except for a small sales tech service operation, come to think of it, not so small, that served the sales department, all of the R&D was in the manufacturing department. And as expected, it was pretty well focused on solving manufacturing problems. But in those days, each oil company was developing its own version of catalysts, reforming, cracking, whatever. And so it was, I guess, not too difficult to do some fairly scientific research based on pretty sound engineering and science in pursuing the catalyst research. And the catalyst background was of great value in my later catalytic research. So there was a combination of fortuitous circumstances. McConnell was especially himself very forbearing and patient with the R&D group about funding and balance of exploratory versus applied research and so on. I have to say, maybe partly by luck, made it easier for him by giving him the acrylate and acrylonitrile processes in a very timely fashion.
Well, that's what I'd like to come back to. You've said that after your 3 months of study, you agreed now on a direction, and within 2 years you were at acrylonitrile. I'm wondering if you could work through some of the details of that time.
Sure. It's fairly well documented, by the way, in a nice article that the Chemical and Engineering News did in 1971, where I was declared one of their chemical innovators. And
okay, I don't have that.
That's a July issue.
Okay.
And
that one we didn't pick up.
It kind of puts the whole picture together. I forget which July issue it was, but I'm sure it was 1971.
Okay.
And the history goes something like this. Of the other the project leaders, I first started work when I was doing this desk work. I reported to another project leader. I was made a project leader approximately a year after I had joined the group. And after it was decided that by consensus, I suppose, that acrylic acid derivatives and glycerin precursors would be a good strategy to pursue. Why I was allowed to take off in that direction, and I actually pursued essentially two projects at the same time. I've always tried to do that. I think working on one project is a mistake. You can work on too many, but one needs an alter ego even among projects. So when one is a little slow, why you work on the other one and then alternate back and forth. So that's what I did. Both projects were successful. We were able to epoxidize acrolein in small yields, but a group at Shell Chemical, forget the gentleman's name, I believe he worked for Charlie Adams of catalytic fame of Shell, in all honesty beat us to the draw there and got to the glycerin by an alternate route using a vapor phase Mirrein-Pondorf barely reduction, which you're familiar with, allyl alcohol followed by hydroxylation. Anyhow, we were locally successful at any rate, both projects. The other one, in oxidizing acrolein to acrylic acid, I had, of course, read into the literature and had found that several other companies, Carbide, distillers at that time, Shell, had been pretty well all over the act there, so the only thing they hadn't done was develop a high-yield process. And a lot of the work had focused on vapor phase processes for oxidation or esterification, and of course those were a total disaster when dealing with something like acrolein. So given the fact that it was a petroleum company with skills in catalysis, why it was predictable that we would take the vapor phase approach. With a lot of trepidation though, because we were dealing in sort of a technology fog of the times. Catalytic science was nowhere near the stage it was now. This was in the mid-50s, and ESCA had been dreamed of, but there were no machines available. Vapor chromatography had just appeared on the scene. Our first determinations of propylene conversion to various aldehydes, acrolein plus other byproducts such as formaldehyde and acetaldehyde, originally were determined by bubbling the reactor stream through a 2,4 dinitrophenylhydrazone solution and separating the solid and doing an infrared scan to determine differences in banding of the different phenylhydrazones. And so, of course, when the first vapor chromatograph came along, why, that removed all of that and speeded up things immensely. But a couple of the other chemists, notably Jim Callahan and Ernie Milberger and Bob Foreman and Bob Griselli, had done work previously on screening a lot of compounds which in search of a selective agent for selective oxidation of propylene to anything of interest. And they had made acetone and a certain amount of acrolein, which was what had our attention at the time. But I stepped up on the shoulders of giants, I guess you would say, to borrow an expression from the literature, and from their teachings began work in the area of the group 6 metal oxides. And a couple of the fellows, including Callahan especially, and Griselli, had looked at the molybdenum compounds as oxidation agents for propylene to acrolein. And the now famous bismuth phosphomolybdate catalyst had been put together by Callahan and Foreman, I think it was, and shown to give rather remarkable selections and conversions of propylene directed to acrolein. No one seems to have given any thought to acrylic acid, much less acrylonitrile. The idea was to make acrolein and see what could be done with it. And so I, borrowing from them, rather easily developed a series of vanadate and molybdate catalysts which were in the vapor phase impregnated on or co-gelled with silica. were able to convert Crowley into acrylic acid in commercially attractive yields. And so the marketing group immediately began an investigation into what the opportunities for acrylates were. Acrylates were mostly made at that time by the Roman Haas technology of adding a CO and an alcohol to acetylene, and which was a process of choice for a long time. And it was a serious contender. We were not sure we'd ever be able to equal it or top it. But we carried forward, and after a while some calculations emerged that acrylic acid via acrylene and propylene was in fact economically viable, and the markets were beginning to look interesting. And Veach was very good in making his, persuading his staff to think in terms of the economic and consequences of an impact of their work. So I would have to say that even at that time, a lot of our strategic technical thinking was economically flavored. Pretty powerful combination. So acrylic acid was brought to a suitable place where it could be handed over to Dr. Milberger's group, whose job was a bench-scale process simulation and advancement, which we defined as the first level of operation in terms of product and feed quantities where reactor variables could be assessed and real economically sound economics would be developed based on yield structures obtained on quantities of material large enough that you were felt confident what you were doing. So at that point, why the question is what to do with acrylic acid, and everybody knew that the use for acrylic acids was either was mostly acrylates or acrylamide, and so I then pursued further work on the vapor phase esterification of acrylic acid over silica gel, which turned out to be much easier than I had thought, and commercially attractive yields in that area were achieved within a matter of a few months. And so then we had the basis of a petrochemical enterprise. Mm-hmm. And about that time, I began to realize that, again, with a lot of encouragement and guidance from Veach and Hughes, that I should start looking for something else to do than acrylic acid and acrylates. So acrylonitrile was always in the background, and so no one had even dared to think that you might do everything in one single reaction or reactor. And so my first approach to acrylic acid or acrylonitrile was a vapor phase conversion of acrylic acid to acrylonitrile with ammonia over a dehydration catalyst. And this work was done knowing that Reppe, I believe, in Germany had already explored this chemistry, but not with economically significant results. So my approach to that was really to see if process refinements would lead to something that would make economic sense given low-cost acrylic acid. And it wasn't too long after that that we came across the distiller's work, which had been uncovered in my earlier researches, in which they had explored the conversion of acrylene and ammonia to acrylonitrile. So I repeated some of their work and looked at alternate chemical variations of their catalysts, which might be more economically advantageous because their yields and conversions were in somewhat of improvement. Do we need to check? So, rather quickly, why I also in the earlier searches had turned up the John Cosby work at Allied, who had done work on a conversion of propylene and propane too, as I recall, and isobutylene to nitriles, and one can only take his hat off and salute to Dr. Cosby. It's I guess a twist of fate that he wasn't working with the right series of compounds. John worked with vanadium phosphomolybdate and obtained identifiable conversions and yields of acrylonitrile. It turned out, as I recall, that when he oxidized, when he M-oxidized propylene, 5 to 6% of acrylo was obtained, but the larger amounts were HCN and acetonitrile byproducts, so you flipped off a methyl group. And when one used isobutylene, why, the principal product was acrylonitrile instead of methacrylonitrile. And so following that, why, it was rather obvious that one should try some of our own selective catalysts that worked for acrylene and acrylic acid and other propylene conversions to that one. And, screening several of those from my own and Dr. Callahan's library of catalysts, very quickly identified two or three candidates that gave very promising acrylonitrile conversions and selectivities from propylene in one pass, and from there it required not too much reactor and reaction optimization to get it into an economically interesting region, and the rest is sort of history. So when people ask, you know, why hasn't this done before and why wasn't this done before, I guess the best answer I can give is that for some reason the obviousness of putting it all together had possibly occurred to a number of other people, but no one had been quite in the same position of having the concept of the idea and the selection of catalysts that were known to be more effective than any of the others previously reported. And the advantage of gas chromatography to quickly analyze the product, the reactor results. We knew we had made a significant quantity of acrylonitrile 5 minutes after the experiment was done. And I remember very well my assistant, Debbie Jonak, who was working at the in the reactor, which I had designed and built pretty much with my own hands with a lot of help from the mechanical shop. It was a mini-fluid bed reactor, by the way. I told her to how to set the instruments and what the feed ratios were to be, and it was all set up to feed propylene, air, ammonia, whatever else we wanted fed. The fluid bed was about 200 cc's of ground catalyst, and as I went off to a meeting with Veach in his office, why, I remember telling her, Evie, if this by any chance works, why, you can come down and break down the door because we really got something big. And about a half an hour later, why, there was a beating on the door and screaming, it worked, it worked. So I said, well, I guess we can take the rest of the day off.
I guess I'm not quite clear how important acrylonitrile was as a starting material at that time. Was it realized that here was an important material that could be used for a number of other end products?
Well, that's a very, if I may be forgiven for saying it, a very perceptive question. Yes, it was realized by a number of people, I think, in the chemical industry, but I really don't think at that time any but a few, and those largely living on pipe dreams, including myself, realized what its capabilities really were. The value of nitrile rubber as gasoline-resistant hose was, of course, what led the Germans to develop it before World War I. And its use as a wool substitute, acrylic fiber, had just been recognized by DuPont and Monsanto and American Cyanamid, and the Orlans and the Acrolans and the Dynels had just become commercial. And first ABS resin had just been made by Carbide, Dow, and Borg Warner, then Marbon, almost simultaneously, and so everybody really felt that it was going to be important, but I don't think anyone really knew how important. Acrylonitrile, and then there were a few minor uses like acrylamide and so on. I don't think that, as I recall, world or U.S. production of acrylonitrile at that time was around 300 million pounds. And so our market people went to work on it, and with some really daring bravado, projected that in 10 years the market might double.
Peter Wattow's on a phone.
Yeah, sure. Now, let's see, where were we?
You were talking about. I had asked you about whether it was you could see at the time what.
Well, I guess I had said that world production was 300, or U.S. production was 300 million at that time. World production was probably twice that. And I've given some talks on it in the past, but I don't have the material available right at hand. But a daring projection was that U.S. production might double in 10 years. Actually, U.S. production went from 300 million pounds a year in 1957 to 2 or 3 billion pounds a year in 1985 or so, and world production of acrylonitrile now, I think, is somewhere between 8 and 10 billion. I will claim a little credit for having been optimistic about where it would go. Acrylonitrile was a pretty unusual monomer. It was different from the other monomers, the acrylates and the methacrylates and vinyls and so on, in that it's a pretty refractory monomer. It is capable of withstanding high temperatures, and because of the nitrile group and its electronegative effect on the double bond, the double bond in acrylonitrile is not very susceptible to oxidation. So a lot of circumstances combine to predict that, particularly in a flood bed reactor, acrylonitrile had a chance of surviving the recirculation, and that if the reactants of choline and or propylene and ammonia could be combined to form the acrylonitrile, that you had a high probability of getting most of it out of the reactor. And I'll claim a small amount of credit for having recognized that at the outset of the experiments.
One of the things I was struck by in an article you wrote, and I wanted to ask you about that, the specific one in a moment, was the very simplicity of the reactor diagram and what was... It really, you couldn't get it any simpler than that.
No, you really couldn't. I remember, I think that remark came from some remarks I overheard one day when Henry Haas was visiting Purdue. And I was lucky enough to be included at the luncheon table. I can't remember just why at the minute, but Henry was, if you knew him, was...
No, I didn't know.
Pretty direct and analytical and decisive individual, and we later became good friends. Among other things, because I went to Purdue half thinking I would work for him, and he had left the year before I got there. But Henry once said, if I can get this right now, if you're going to produce any chemical, you must do three things. You must do it the simplest way, you must use the most available raw materials, and you must do it the least costly way. And I guess that's rather obvious, but I've always applied those guidelines to any process or product research I ever undertook.
The economic thinking that you said you were instilled with when you went to Standard, I'm going back to chemical engineering education kinds of things, mm-hmm. where I'm assuming at that time that was not part of the economic considerations were not really discussed in terms of chemical engineering, or am I wrong?
No, I think they were. Okay. Norris Shreve, Benny, we called him, was quite firm about that, okay. and we got a strong dose of that in his introductory chemical process industries course, which was a course numbered so that it could be taken either as a senior or as a first-year graduate student. And he also had a famous quotation that when one writes equations for chemical reactions, if it's to be industrially applied, somewhere the dollar sign must appear in the denominator. I never forgot that.
Oh, thank you very much.
Thanks, Georgette. Mm-hmm.
Because the economic aspect is something that chemistry majors rarely ever see.
Well, I don't mean to suggest that my career was guided by nothing but the dollar sign, but I think that for an industrial chemist, the dollar sign has to be there always. But on the other hand, it can be an anchor, and I think for an industrial chemist or even an academic chemist or scientist, that you must not let your horizons be damned by economic constraints, because that will prevent you from thinking as broadly as one should. But eventually there has to be a reconciliation if there's to be an industrial process. Mm-hmm. Now, you can have products that are valued at millions of dollars a pound, such as interferons and things like that, but still there's an economic constraint.
In the 57 to 60, the plant in Lima went on stream 3 years later,
right, which I think is a new record for the industry.
It's amazing. And in your 1960 paper, you wrote, and I'm quoting now, "Simultaneous research, development, and design highlight the rapid commercialization of this new product."
Yes, and I'll be happy to enlarge on that. Again, the Hughes-Veatch combine, perhaps with a little bit of Idle and Callahan and Milburger injected, made us recognize that if we did have anything really good here, it wouldn't wait. Somebody else would have done it if we hadn't. And we were lucky, I think, at that time to have three people on the scene that deserve a lot of credit that I haven't mentioned yet. One was our vice president for the chemical division, Ed Morrow, who was busy trying to make a living running Ohio's newly constructed ammonia and nitric acid and urea plants while trying to godfather the acrylates and acrylonitrile work and finance it out of his budget. And he was quite a patient person, but a chemical engineer himself and very insightful. Another was, and he's now passed on, bless his soul, another is Ed San, who came from Ed, S-A-N-N. I can't remember if he was here from Hercules or one of the other companies in Delaware. But at any rate, he was our market research person who was very encouraging of the laboratory work as being economically and industrially significant. And he had retained a New York consultant, a gentleman by the name of Herman Neuenhaus, NIEUWENHAUS, apparently had the attention and the respect of the Soheil management all the way up to the president. And he said to them, when the acrylonitrile discovery was made known to them, that if they really wanted to do anything of significance, that they should focus on this acrylonitrile discovery, because it alone had the possibility of making Standard Oil of Ohio overnight a factor in the chemical industry as well as the petroleum industry. And they apparently listened to him.
Very perceptive.
I agreed with him, of course.
Because it just so happens I have a quote here from, I think this is Spitz's book on the petrochemical industry. Idle's discovery helped turn Soheil into a major force in petrochemicals and brought the company hundreds of millions of dollars in licensing fees.
I would have to say accurately put.
I'm just curious, why the plant in Lima? Why was that this?
Because we had a refinery there, and we had across-the-fence propylene and across-the-fence ammonia.
Okay. See, I'm old enough to only associate Lima with the luck of
Right. Right. Yeah, so Ohio had one of their larger refineries there, and that's where the ammonia plant was built.
Okay. And as I said earlier, you had written this article in 1960 in Chemical Engineering Progress.
That was one co-authored by Veach and Milberger, I think.
Yeah, I think I have it here. New Route to Acrylonitrile.
Yeah.
I'm curious about the attitude of companies towards writing papers in the literature about their new processes. So I was wondering what the impetus was behind this paper.
Well, I would have to say that given the economic opportunity that had been presented them, Soheil management was more encouraging than I would have expected about certain of these publications. They, I think, did realize that Firstus was going to be very important. If they, a midget, compared to the Shells and the Exxons and the Carbides, were to get this done. So some public knowledge of who Soheil was and what they had done was in order. So they encouraged these kind of publications rather than discouraged. I think they understandably take the position that most other companies do about technology publications, which tend to reveal their secrets, and even after patents are issued, this sounds like heresy in an academic environment, but there's understandable reason, if not reluctance, on the part of companies to use great caution about the public exposure that they give to their science and technology in scientific meetings. And there has to be a balance. If you want to maintain image and attract people, you can't be silent, but you can give away kitchen sinks if you're not careful. I remember an invited paper that I was asked to give, I believe it was at the Minneapolis ACS meeting in 1969, honoring, I think, Alex Oblad was getting the Murphy Award at that time, and my good friend Heinz Heinemann, formerly of Mobil, was organizing the symposium and asked me to give a paper on the acrylo process. The theme of the symposium was new processes, and Oblad, I believe, was getting the award for the Kelchlor process. And so I put together what I thought was a reasonably restrictive paper on the acrylonitrile process that would combine some attractions and some good technology content at the same time, combined with a little bit of commercial advertising, and sent down to the patent department to have screened, and what I got back was virtually a paper with a lot of whiteout on it. So the usual tussle ensued, and I got to present something that was between where I had started and where they had finished. But it was interesting. I, although they're supposed to not be allowed in ACS meetings, I think I must have counted 24 cameras in the audience snapping every slide I gave.
Well, that leads me to another question, and that is several questions relating to patents. One was, did you have any problems, given that there was some other work in the area already, in terms of getting this patented in short order?
Well, not as much as I would have expected, but I really can't take any credit for the patent process. That was carried out with great skill by two very talented patent attorneys at Sohio, Leland L. Chapman, who was the person who took strongly the position that Idle was the first person to put this whole combination of things together, and therefore he is the sole inventor instead of four or five co-inventors, about which I had some serious concern about whose name really should be on it. And I just tossed the matter in his lap and said, whatever decision you make, I will happily live with, because I've drawn on the work of several other people. But given that, perhaps the biggest obstacle was the prior reference to the Cosby patent, and that was simply resolved on the basis, as I understand it, that the chemical composition of the catalyst used was different. It didn't matter whether I got it off its Ohio shelf or ordered it from a chemical company. The idea was the combination, including the concepts. And secondly, since one of the tests for patentability is reduction to practice and utility, they argued partly that the Idle process had on the basis of yields and conversions economic utility, where the others did not.
Okay. Were there any suits that followed as a result?
Yes, of course. There was a famous distiller suit, which all centered around whether or not acrolein was an intermediate, because if it was, why, we had violated their patent.
Okay.
And much of my early conjecture had been on the basis that acrolein could be an intermediate. Some beautiful mechanistic work done by Art Strecker and Bob Griselli and Jim Callahan and Ernie Milberger later showed the existence and the kinetics of the famous Lillick intermediate, which in fact reacted faster with adsorbed ammonia to form acrylonitrile than it could by converting itself first to acrolein and thence to acrylonitrile, and that's a classic in catalytic mechanistic work. And on that basis, why it was resolved out of court. Not without an awful lot of depositions and several years of hassling.
I've talked to several people who tell me that it almost goes with the territory, but it's not one of their favorite things.
That's about right, yeah. But it was a learning experience.
Were you, and we discussed this at lunch earlier, when I cited John Francis' case, were you involved in development up to getting the whole process on stream on large scale?
Yes, that's right. We sort of got sidetracked. When the process was discovered, it was quickly realized that we had to move it forward quickly. And we interviewed several major construction firms, and on the basis of some past exposure to Sohio, selected the Badger Company to do the work for us. And several of their people, a notable fellow who's now passed on, bless his heart, Russ Sheely, and two or three others, Phil Siever, who was a VP at the time, came up with the idea of telescoping the a lot of the development phases, and that they would design the plant itself while the pilot work was still being done, and that we would simply leap certain aspects of piloting where possible on the premise that the money saved or the money earned by having the plant on stream earlier would more than compensate for final plant fix-it work, even if it had to be done. Now, there had to be some limits put on this. We couldn't just be outrageously daring, but I think that strategy was responsible for the three-year elapsed time between the first laboratory successful experiment, which was March 7, 1957, and approximately spring 1960, when the plant first was put into operation. And we did construct a pilot plant version of the reactor, which was an 18-inch diameter flood bed reactor, which held, I think, about, as I recall, it was give or take 1,000 pounds of catalyst. And that operated pretty much according to theory. The recovery section of the plant, which at that time, why, they had no one to take the responsibility for either pilot planning or doing the bench scale work to prove out the Badger design for the recovery plant. So I either volunteered or was assigned to do that. I can't remember which. And so we operated mock-up Oldershaw column experiments with all the synthetic feed streams that the Badger people, with some help from us, theorized would result from the reactor operation. And I worked these all up in the laboratory using 2 or 3 or 4 inch Oldershaw columns, and the Badger people expertly but daringly extrapolated these to 6 and 8 foot diameter columns, which were built in the plant without ever having been in any way significantly piloted at all. We did operate an absorber column and a recovery column to give a fourfold scale up factor for mine in the laboratory, but we did telescope all of that, and even the reactors for the plant were being designed while the pilot plant reactors were being done. The theory being that changes in blueprints don't cost anything but paper, ink, and draftsman's time. Changes in metal are expensive, but you can do a lot by telescoping, and that's what was done. And in the plant, we had essentially predictable operation based on the development and advancement work. There was only one relatively major fix-it item in the plant, where one column had to be changed from what amounted to a knockdown column for a heavies to a type of quenching tower, which incidentally I had installed in my own reactor at the bench scale level, and somehow didn't get translated to the first plant blueprint. But there was some more trouble in the startup of the plant due to unexpected concentrations of byproducts and some polymer formation here and there, but in general, the plant did, in fact, go into trouble-free operation within a year of its startup, and I think this is a pretty interesting illustration of what can be done to really shorten commercialization times when you're willing to take some risks. And I spent a year in the plant feeling columns and looking at temperature indicators and sampling tops and bottoms and doing material balances, and it was an experience I wouldn't trade.
terms of the catalyst, it was an in-house catalyst then?
Entirely. We later licensed its production, but it was an in-house creation entirely.
Because now all of a sudden you have a bigger demand for this catalyst.
Yes.
Right? So
yeah,
you have to.
Yeah. Well, and that's another aspect of it that we should not pass. The management made what I thought, and a lot of people thought, was the management made what a few of us thought was an extremely wise decision on how to commercialize, which really sort of went against the grain of chemical industry tradition. Early on, with the help of Morrow and Hughes and Chapman, who was not only patent counsel but a leading negotiator for licensing agreements, that if we had something this good, that it would be a classic mistake to try and use this environmentally, economically advantageous technology to produce acrylonitrile for the world. People will always look for sources of alternate supply. In addition, there were the existing acrylonitrile manufacturers using the old HCN acetylene process, and it would have been, by hindsight, counterproductive for us to try to put them out of business. So the decision to license was wisely made after we had brought our first plant into operation and its commercial viability was proven. And at that point, the old technologies based on acetylene and HCN and ethylene oxide and HCN all folded and ceased operation within 5 years, and the major producers from the DuPonts and the Monsantos and the Carbides on licensed the Sahio technology.
Okay.
So without question, they made the right decision, and the licensing incomes, which vastly exceeded the operating income from our own plant, proved them right.
Did the Lima plant continue, though? I mean,
I understand the Lima plant is now closed. I'm not sure of that. If it's not, it's probably close to being closed. When Sahio and BP merged, a new facility at Green Lake, Texas, was put into operation, and that is now, as I understand it, operated by contract by Sterling Chemical or something like that. And it was a 600 million pound facility, which at that time was the largest acrylo plant that had ever been constructed.
I guess as a native of Ohio, just as an aside, I have an awful time when I'm there not seeing any Sahio stations anymore, but only BP.
Yeah, so. I look wistfully back on that myself. Sahio is a unique organization. And off the record, I'm not sure that the best interests of the stockholders or the country were served by that merger. The old research center is a ghost of his former self and probably is closed by now, or is almost.
I'll have to go by there the next time I'm in Cleveland.
I think it's still operating with a skeleton.
Well, what do you do for an encore after you've been at Sahio only a few years and here you are responsible for this major innovation?
Well, that was difficult. I had a choice of continuing in the chemical and the catalyst area, which maybe was a mistake not to do. I continue and always have had a high interest in catalytic reactions and still do when I get the opportunity to research in catalyst chemistry. And we talked about some earlier that I'm currently starting to work in. At that time, the question of what to do with all this acrylonitrile, and we launched a polymer group to see if we could find any novel uses for acrylonitrile outside the uses that were already commercial and where we would not have to compete with our customers. And this polymer group grew rather rapidly again under Veach. It had a leader for a while whose name I don't immediately remember, who was very competent but apparently interested in other areas, so he went to another section of the company. And I had begun to try to become a homegrown polymer chemist, so with some fear I switched fields to polymer chemistry and was asked by Veach to lead the polymer efforts at Ohio. And at that time, the barrier properties of high nitrile films were just beginning to be recognized. And Ohio had, at the time I took the helm of polymers, had developed by a casting process a polyacrylonitrile film, which was a wonderful film, and I probably still may find uses when it went through the Delaney problem with acrylonitrile being a carcinogenic material, but that's now largely resolved because if you want to, you can get the monomer contents of those films so low that you really don't have extractables. So as a food container, why nitrile containing resins of some formulations are acceptable and even for beverages, I believe the FDA clearance has now been reached. Anyhow, I concluded that they were right about the nitrile film and barrier type packaging material opportunities, but the fatal flaw was that you had to cast it, and that's a very expensive way to make a film. So some research had already been started on making a thermoplastic version of polyacrylonitrile, and as you probably know, PAN itself, because of the high attraction between the nitrile dipoles, is not a thermoplastic. It cross-links and decomposes before it diffuses for conversion. But work done by a lady by the name of June Duke and two gentlemen by the name of Drs. Frank Vincent and Bill Donovan and Ralph Isley had shown that it's of course possible to make nitrile polymers with acrylate comonomers, a name known to us from other earlier work, that could with some difficulty be fused. And the question was how much of the barrier property of acrylonitrile remained if you put enough monomer in it to internally plasticize it. And about that time, calling back on the work of Norman Grassi, who did some of the first diphtheridine ring decomposition work, and one of our own very bright young chemists, Dr. Larry Ball, found that there were certain critical impurities which, if removed from nitrile copolymers, greatly improved their resistance to decomposition. So with that, we were able to develop a copolymer of methyl acrylate and acrylonitrile, which had a fine combination of barrier properties. It was an average barrier to water, but it was a superb barrier to CO2 and oxygen and nitrogen and some other things. The only problem was it was brittle, and we could blow mold it in a blow molding machine, but it was still brittle. It did respond to orientation, and later we and Monsanto and some others found a way to stretch blow that cured the brittleness problem, but that technology was not advanced at that time. Only Phillips's Orbet process for polypropylene was known. We didn't have access to a Phillips machine. So again, calling on the skills of the group, I directed the research towards developing a reinforcing agent that would impart impact resistance. So borrowing from ABS technology, the group prepared an acrylonitrile butadiene rubber with enough acrylonitrile in it that its elasticity was not harmed,
Which also had the same refractive index as the base resin which we grafted onto it. And thus was born what is called Barrex resin, which the market people imaginatively named it. And this turned out to be the item which is now a commercial article for high barrier packaging of foods and beverages. Well, not beverages, but a lot of processed foods, meats, industrial products, pharmaceuticals especially, which require oxygen and CO2 protection. Interestingly, we instantly recognized the opportunity in carbonated beverage bottles, and we approached some beverage companies, Coca-Cola and Pepsi-Cola and ginger ale and a few others, and Pepsi-Cola was the first to jump. And we asked them for a list of properties that they would like in a plastic barrier bottle. And, of course, the answer came back, well, it should look as clear as glass, and it should bounce like rubber, and it must hold 75 PSI internal pressure and be a barrier to CO2 and everything like that. And it turned out that Barrex did all of that. The first carbonated beverage bottles that were field tested in the United States were Barrex, and that was 25 years ago. And here is one of those bottles. It's cloudy. Oh. It's cloudy today because the rubber stabilizers have long since been used up by the light, but. At one time, that bottle was clear as glass and bounced off of concrete floors and things like that.
It's brittle now. Yeah.
Probably, yeah. In those days, well, you could slam a file drawer on it and it wouldn't crack.
And it says in new plastic bottles.
Yeah,
that's interesting.
Yeah.
Right on, they're making a point of it in there.
Yeah, that bottle is 25 years old. Mm. And. The only thing it didn't have, and I told him it didn't, was sufficient thermal and creep resistance. And if you put it in a hot car trunk in the summertime, it will expand. But it does keep the material flavorful and everything else for 2 years. Hmm. What we did do, of course, unknowingly, was pave the way for PET, because it turns out that most carbonated beverages are consumed within 10 days of being bottled. And so if you put them on the shelf, there's no problem with PET. It's not a good barrier, but it's good enough. And it happened at the time that this series of experiments was completed and the market study was completed. The market study showed that a carbonated beverage bottle would be a howling, in plastic, would be a howling success. It would have to be less expensive. It would have to have better heat resistance. It also happened at that time that the 3 billion pound PET capacity in the United States was only 50% utilized, and the PET industry was looking hungrily for something else to do with their material. So it didn't take DuPont and the others very long to discover how to orient a PET bottle, and so that's why we're where we are today.
So this would have been 69, you said 25 years?
69. Yes, that's about right. It was in the late 60s and early 70s.
Right.
The work on that began in about 63. And I took over the plastic research at Ohio in 62. So that was the follow-on, and then... Then later I got into work on other polymers. We did work on unique synthesis of unsaturated polyesters by using olefin oxides directly in place of ethylene glycol, so you didn't have water of reaction and that sort of thing. And,
had you, before 1977, had you... ever thought of leaving Columbus, Ohio?
Not really. And I probably would still be there today but for two things. A friend of mine had dropped my name without my knowledge to a executive recruiting firm, and I had some concern about how the I guess I'd better be careful how I phrase this, about how the opportunities for upper management positions would be in a corporate acquisition, which in the end amounted to a takeover. So when the offer came, why, instead of not listening to it, I chose to listen.
One other thing before we reach that 1977 point. You listed starting in 1964 as somebody who had an influence on your career or your life was Dr. Henry Gray.
Yes.
And I'm wondering if you could...
Well, Henry David Gray is a fascinating person. He just died on September 3rd at the age of 86 this year. But I met him quite by, I guess the word accident is not the right word. Maybe it was by someone's intent from somewhere. In Hartford, Connecticut, where I spent a lot of time with a consulting firm that I had hired, or that Ohio had hired, to do work on my trials. And I was really raised in a believing religious family, and that continues. And Dr. Gray was at once a great scholar and a great friend, and was in need of a little guidance on career matters at the time, and somehow we just sort of clicked. But he earned my respect the instant I met him. And we had become fast friends over the years, and I have some interest, a lot of interest, I should say, in things religious and theological. I don't flaunt it too much, but it's a matter of deep interest to me. And he was, until his death, probably one of the four or five leading congregational scholars in the world. He was invited to be the keynote speaker at the 350th congregational anniversary at Westminster Cathedral in England, for which he had written a sermon, which his son David had to give because Dr. Gray had fallen and broken his hip just 2 weeks prior to his anticipated departure. But I remain almost an adopted member of their family, and I consider it an absolute miracle and privilege to have met a man like that.
Where was he located?
He was pastor of the Old South Congregational Church in Hartford, Connecticut, which is the 10th oldest church in the United States. And he was their 13th minister. And even among churches, that one is unusual for the tenure of its ministers, and each tenure is around 35 years.
That is unusual.
He is quite a guy. I could go on for hours about him.
Again, I'm quoting from something you wrote in 1974. Acrylonitrile trial containing polymers have grown from being a laboratory curiosity to one of the most prominent and useful types of polymers over the past 40 years. And the growth has occurred stepwise.
Mm-hmm.
Synthetic rubber, fiber, molding, resin applications, and so on.
And packaging. You should distinguish that from molding resins.
Okay.
Because molding resins, to most people, denote ABS resins and SAN resins, and they're a chapter of their own. ABS, I believe, is now a larger consumer of acrylonitrile than fibers. And then there's the chemical area, which is largely polyacrylamide. But that has extensive use in gelling agents, thickening agents, drilling muds, and so on. So it has become quite an interesting material. And now it is the basis of a new form of polymer type called the dendritic polymer or the dendrite, which is a cluster polymer grown much like, it looks sort of like a coral, if you will, which grows outward by the addition of Michael-type additions to alpha-beta unsaturates, which can be derived from acrylonitrile, which is anhydrogenated to the corresponding amine, which is reacted with more acrylonitrile and grows outward.
I see.
And it's a rather fascinating new form of polymer. Another one which is interesting is the so-called flat polymer, which has recently been published on by George Whitesides at Harvard.
Okay.
And that's the carpet type, if you will.
Okay.
So polymer chemistry is doing interesting things, still some of it based on acrylonitrile.
But isn't it true that polymer chemistry has never really gotten the recognition it should have in chemistry departments?
I agree with that totally. And one has to recognize, of course, what one means by polymer. If we mean synthetic polymers, synthetic polymer methods, synthetic polymer characterization techniques, and polymer physics, yes, I think that's probably right. It's just now coming into its own. Polymer chemistry, I think, probably finally got legitimized somewhere in the 60s, although very more of those schools like Akron and Brooklyn Poly, then Brooklyn Poly, now New York, were pioneers in the field. And one of the early ones was, of course, the Case Center at Cleveland. Early on.
Okay.
But if you look more broadly at polymers and quickly get to proteins and sugars and naturally occurring polymers, why, of course, polymer chemistry has been around forever. And I think the thing that makes it all the more significant now is that the methods for characterization of any polymer, organic or inorganic or natural or synthetic, are beginning to get the overview treatment that they should have had. But it certainly is true that in the early days, education in polymer chemistry was achieved primarily in the industrial sector and not in the academic sector. And the academicians were slow, if not reticent, to realize it.
But even today, isn't it true that a lot of polymer work is done in engineering departments?
Oh, absolutely.
Schools,
absolutely. And that's given the course that polymer science, if you will, has had to follow in the last 25 or 30 years. It's very understandable. The development of polymer technology, development of polymer science has been technology directed and therefore commercially and industrially influenced. And I guess it's natural that the development of polymer science in the universities would follow what is sort of a retro path in coming back through the engineering schools, who are the first ones to respond to industrial needs for fabrication and processing, and finally leaping, as is necessary in some cases, the academic fence between engineering and science. Now, there are some schools that manage that with a lot more skill than others. I probably should not go further there.
Do you want say something about your move to Ashland Chemical in 77?
Well, since the focus is on the Perkin metal and that centers around acrylonitrile and its derivatives, why we probably should make that good on the briefer side.
Sure.
But that was, I guess, a mid-career change, which I was ready for. It certainly offered a combination of management and science opportunities that was not immediately open at Sohio. And I took it for both career and economic reasons. It was a nice jump in remuneration and for rank as well. But the gentleman who persuaded me to come to Ashland, one of my classmates at Purdue, Jim Lewis, now resting, bless his heart, was another unique kind of industrial chemical administrator, himself a PhD physical chemist, and one of his requirements was that the person he hired for this position of manager venture research and development, which translates micro corporate, was that he be both a scientist and a manager, and that he was expected to remain a scientist and, as well as a manager, so it had all the fittings that I wanted. And so it was a pretty much of a romance from the start. It was not without its problems, as any job is, but I largely working through other people, and I've always in my life tried to be careful not to foist my name on somebody's publication or patent, and I think I can claim I've never done that. It's only there when it belongs. There's probably a lot of times when it doesn't belong that it should have been there. But they wanted to develop a presence in the petrochemical industry, building on petrochemical monomers just as Ohio did. And I think they were hoping for another acrylonitrile, hoping lightning would strike twice. And they had some very nice polymer work on which a lot of their chemical company sales were based. And so we developed some very nice products there, among other things. And it's in my resume that you'll see is the process for methyl methacrylate based on propylene and CO, which was pilot planted and in the economic crisis of the early 80s, Ashland simply did not have the money to carry that forward, or I think they would have. So it was after some exploration license to a European firm who built a semi-works, and I continue to think we'll at the right time build a world-scale plant on it. It offers somewhere between a 20% and 30% cost advantage for methacrylates over the time-honored cyanhydrin process, and more important, you don't have to work with HCN to make it. You can, anybody who has a refinery can have an MMA plant, and on an equal plant size basis, if you talk about a billion-pound plant, a lot of people have seen billion-pound styrene plants. Nobody's ever seen more than a 300-million-pound pound-a-year MMA plant line. But at equal plant size, which with the propylene CO process is possible, MMA could be priced to the market probably 20 to 30% lower than styrene. Styrene derives from benzene at 25 cents a pound and ethylene at 10 to 12. And propylene and CO are roughly 14 to 15 and 6 to 8 cents a pound, respectively. And I think the world could do a lot with MMA that it doesn't do in those prices. We also developed the world's first engineering rim resin, which found its first use in 1986 General Motors automobiles, and a new type of thermoplastic, or a new type of composite matrix resin with a coefficient of linear thermal expansion 5 times lower than epoxies, which are now used. And that's, as far as I know now, being advanced into aircraft uses with some major manufacturing firms. And there were some other things, but that's, that was sort of where things were at Ashland when I left there. And so being offered the 10-carat parachute, I took it, and here I am at Rutgers.
Just a brief word, I think, about the... I was not aware that there was a packaging engineering, such a thing as a packaging engineering department.
Yeah.
So maybe a brief word about this department and its origin and your role here.
Well, to put it in perspective, the oldest and largest packaging school in the United States is at Michigan State, which is larger than all the rest of them combined, and they have a very fine school. There are also fine schools at RIT and Clemson, Cal Poly, Wisconsin, one in Indiana at, can't think of the name at the minute, 14 around the country. The Rutgers program, which is the second oldest and third largest, originated here in 1965 in the food science department, and as the science of materials began to become more important in packaging, why it moved to the engineering college, where it was recognized by my predecessor that the design and production of packages is really an engineering function. And if you look at the fact that half of thermoplastics are used in packaging, and that some very significant portion, I keep trying to arrive at the proper number, of the gross national product is packaging related. Packaging is a very pervasive and important subject. Two things that I like to make note of is that there is a direct correlation. Chemists used to correlate the level of a civilization by how much sulfuric acid they consumed. There's also a direct correlation between life quality in the countries and regions of the world and the amount and sophistication level of the packaging they use. And the second sort of verbal gem is one I think of my own coining. Modern packages are engineered products made from engineered materials. Paper, glass, metals, plastics are all very engineered materials, and the forming of a package is a very engineered, is an engineering process. So, yes, packaging engineering, I think, is emerging as an engineering field in the same way that aeronautical engineering emerged from the marriage of civil and mechanical engineering 50 years ago, and chemical engineering emerged from chemistry and mechanical engineering with a little electrical thrown in 100 years ago. And right now, like all universities, why Rutgers is struggling with its budgets and how to survive, and the question is whether the small packaging tiger will get eaten by the larger tigers in the cage. But so far, why the program is surviving and expanding. Very challenging.
What I'd like to do now is turn to this list, which
yeah.
I think you saw.
Yes.
We've covered a number of things on this list, but let me just pull in a few more questions here, if I may. What does scientific innovation mean to you from your experience? There are many different ways of defining it, and I'm looking at...
Yeah. I didn't have a chance to do much homework on that list before this meeting because of the short time. I guess I'd like to think up a better answer than I'm just likely to give off the top of my head and phone it down to you. Let's arrange for a phone call a week later or something.
All right.
I think innovation has a even though patents are granted only on the basis of novelty and utility, I think innovation, to me, connotes, in many, if not most cases, a unique combination of disciplines, rubbing two technology or science areas together that result in the development or the origin of a concept or a material or a technique that didn't exist previously. And also, innovation also, to me, has, again, a utilitarian or an economic baseline in it that says an innovation must in some way be useful, not just novel.
Okay. Good. Every time I ask this question, I get it's a different twist. Because it's based on experience, and everyone's experience is different. So I'm intrigued by the difference.
Am I in the mainstream?
Oh yes, no, it's, yeah. It all fits. It all yeah. fits very nicely. But there's no two that are alike, which is quite interesting.
I think one thing I'd add about innovation is innovation can have analogies in them that result from historic origins. I think sometimes you are led to innovation by looking backwards and then looking ahead. And so I'm a great advocate of the study of science history.
Shoulders of giants, you said
shoulders
earlier.
Shoulders of giants, if you will. Trying to learn from how other people have combined different areas.
Scientific teamwork. You cited a number of people that you were, mm-hmm. and what's your experience with scientific teamwork?
Well, I think first of all you have to look at it in two categories. The shoulders of giants concept, I think, is one of the most valid ones that I've heard put forth in my lifetime. You don't do anything in science but that you build on what others have done before you, however you want to put it, shoulders of giants or whatever. And in that connection, I think that drawing on that background and the knowledge that others have built before you, you have to give proper credit to generation of concepts or ideas which one is apt to feel are totally original, which in fact rarely ever are. But that process, I think, given that it occurs that way, usually occurs in one brain rather than many simultaneously. I think the idea of six men sitting around a table all jumping up Eureka at the same time is a fairy tale.
Okay.
On the other hand, once a concept or invention has been made, it's the laws of probability of its ever being put forward without a team effort are infinitesimal. Simply because teams are by nature multidisciplinary, and that's how things get from the laboratory to the marketplace. That's as simply as I can put it.
Great. What did you do in terms of contacts outside the company, peer relationships, but in other areas, other companies? Did you have that much of that, or were you isolated?
No, I was encouraged to do it, and I had a lot of them. A lot of them came through professional society work. The record, of course, shows that I was pretty active in the American Chemical Society and to some lesser extent in a number of others. The Industrial Research Institute, which I was not active at all in, it's Ohio because the representation was held by other members, but I became very active in it in Ashland and worked on many of their committees. And I've always done a lot of networking, but not exactly through societies. A lot of times just by reading of journals or articles and contacting people and establishing acquaintances. I've been lucky to be in organizations that encourage that. Some don't, I think.
Right, exactly. That's why I was asking the question.
Yeah, exactly.
Changes in company R&D support during your career. The support, the attitude of the senior management towards R&D, did you see? What kind of changes did you see over your career?
Well, I think in my experiences at Ohio, it was nearly always positive. In a couple of times at Ohio, we went through the usual assessment processes by outside agencies, and these caused a predictable and understandable amount of shock and nervousness, but with the exception of one such experience or one such occurrence, I think the company dealt pretty wisely with their professional staff. There was one occasion when I think that they employed the wrong organization and it was the wrong time to do it. But companies have to guard against deadwood. It's a fact of life. And deadwood, after a time, becomes ironwood, which becomes an anchor. I think also that in my experience in both Ohio and Ashland, that the management attitude was very largely positive. Underwent some stressful times when, because of economic circumstances, the company had to decide what operations to curtail, and usually research and advertising are the two that go first. And I think those two companies were just followed the pattern. I am concerned, as a lot of people are, about the downsizing trend in virtually, it's virtually sweeping across industry. And I'm also concerned about, now that I can speak safely from the whatever security there is in an academic chair, I think that in many cases it's going to prove to be penny wise and pound foolish. Particularly in technology-based corporations where survival, much less a highly profitable operation, depends on advantageous technology. One is eating the seed corn to cut off all the short-range fix-it type research. The concept that some companies seem to have taken, that we don't need to develop our own technology, whatever is needed we can go out and buy it, turns out to be a big misconception. Purchased technology is just like an automobile. The minute you drive it out of the showroom, it starts to depreciate. And if you're not prepared to support it, maintain it, and develop new generations, you better not buy it in the first place.
Well, you've just answered my next question, which is great. But you, at lunch today, you had, I wanted you to repeat the analogy you gave me of the 50s through the 90s.
Oh.
I really enjoyed that.
Well, I can't remember just when this was. I believe it was in the early 80s. I was asked to give a members and fellows lecture for the American Institute of Chemists. And in it, I was... can't remember, either asked or decided to address the economic trend across the chemical and the chemical related industries in the time frames that I had seen them, and make some projections. And I did this. There's a copy of that paper somewhere, but I don't know where it is, probably in Ohio. But I remember using the expressions the fabulous 50s, the soaring 60s, the sobering 70s, the awesome 80s, and the 90s, several terms that we haven't quite selected yet, but it would not be a very positive outlooking term. And yet, one must be cautious never to abandon optimism and see the bright side of things. One door seldom closes, but another opens.
I have one last question on my list, and that is, what did it mean to you to win the Perkin Medal?
Well, it was a great surprise. One always hopes for something like that, but when I opened the letter and found out what it read, at first it was a little bit unbelievable, and then I thought, well, I'd better make sure this is really what I think it is and not just a mistake or a misreading on my part. So I timidly lifted the phone and put in a call to Ed Jefferson, never dreaming that he would answer the telephone at his own house. And I said, "Dr. Jefferson, is this true?" And he said, "Who's this?" And I said, "Well, it's Jim Idle." And he said, "Oh, yes, congratulations." So Ed and I became, if not close friends, rather good friends that instant.
Is there anything else you'd like to add at this point that we
not that covered? I can think of. I believe you've downloaded me very effectively. If I think of anything, I'll be sure to pass it along.
All right. If you find a copy of this talk, because
yes,
you mentioned this, I'd appreciate
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I'll sure look for that.
And I'd like to thank you for spending the afternoon with me. It was delightful. I've enjoyed it, and it's some very good information here.
It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you.
I think another factor that I hope in some cases I've managed to remember, but that in other cases I humbly suggest might be a guideline for developing chemical technology or new technology of any kind. One question that ought to be answered or addressed is, does it help people, or where might it be used? And is there any possibility that it might harm people? And if so, is the cost-benefit ratio justifiable?
Okay.